Howdy, folks, and welcome to Pushing Cardboard. I'm Grant Lindeberg, glad to have you back to talk about some more war games. Or, if this is your first episode, welcome indeed. This is episode 12, The People's Choice. We'll be looking at two games as usual, one relatively newer, one a bit older. I polled the users of pushingcardboard.com, the website, and these two games were the most popular in terms of the options I presented. So the first one is a great choice, as I think it's maybe the next game coming out of C3i Magazine is based on the same engine as this one. It's Trevor Bender's Battle for Kursk, The Tigers of Burning, 1943. I last played this a year ago at the San Diego Online HistCon. We played live over Vassal, and we had a great time with it. Then the older game we'll be talking about is Hammer of the Scots. I haven't presented any of the games in that series yet, so it's great to start with a game that started it all, really. I want to say thanks to those who dropped by the website and voted in the polls. I'll attempt to keep some new ones coming. And please drop by the forums, let me know what you think. Not just about the website, but also about the podcast, the YouTube channel, whatever else is on your mind in wargame land. News and what I've been playing. So, first up, news. This is the last episode before I head off to GMT's weekend at the warehouse. I've managed to connect with a few folks that'll be there. No promises, but I'll be taking my recording gear so I can try snag an interview or two while I'm there, if I run into any designers or what have you, and I'll post them in future episodes. In the meantime, drop by the website or Twitter, let me know if you're going to be there. Maybe we can hook up for a game or something. In other news, good news for those of you who missed out on Herman Luttman's A Most Fearful Slaughter from Flying Pig. It's been a much played and discussed game over the past month, and it sold out immediately. But the word is, they're going to launch another Kickstarter for a reprint very soon. So that's good news for me in particular, as I think the Kickstarter ships to Canada, even if Flying Pig regularly doesn't. Looking forward to getting my hands on that. I saw a few calls for backers for projects from Compass, but nothing that made me open my wallet this month. Over at Revolution Games, they've still got a sale going on. It's two latest titles, Death of an Army and Warsaw 1920. I'm really enjoying Death of an Army still, I'd say snap that up. The prices are reasonable even when they're not on sale, so this is a great offer. Legion Games has a terrific-looking new game on World War One air combat coming up, but it's a solo game, so I'll be passing on that. I'm still searching for the very best World War One air game. They also have an upcoming game on the Naval War on Lake Ontario, 1812, but again, that's solo, so no good for me. They're killing me here, because those a couple of subjects that really interest me. I did submit a pre-order for La Primogenita, Kim Kanger's next game. It's on the East Africa campaign in 1941. It's a topic he's done before with his game Road to Karen, which I already have, but I'm still in the mode of pretty much buying anything else he designs. He's a top shelf designer and graphic designer as well. Game designer, graphic designer, all rolled into one. If you haven't checked out their website recently, Legion has quite a few inviting looking titles in their pre-order queue. So head over to the website, check it out. Worthington has a Kickstarter for Archie's War just finishing. It's a Guadalcanal game. It says it has both two-player and solo rules. I've been burned on that before, so I'm going to take a pass until I hear more about this one. Vuca from Italy has a couple new games. The Chase of the Bismarck uses a double-blind system. And one of the co-designers is naval design legend Jack Green. The other is P. Gebhardt, who designed Donnerschlag, a game that's seeing a lot of play at the moment in my timeline, anyway. The other new game is 1914 Knock Paris. It's an operational World War One. Looks huge. Looks really huge. These VUCA games are fairly pricey coming all the way from Italy, but having bought their first two games, I can certainly vouch that the component quality is top-notch. I look forward to playing the two that I have and seeing if the game quality matches the component quality. Finally, the latest GMT update announced a few more things shipping. For me, the mission pack for Last 100 Yards is the one thing that they've got shipping that's coming my way. But more exciting, really, was their announcement of a new module for Fighting Formations. It's called the 29th Infantry Division. I don't much like the trend of tactical games following certain units rather than whole nationalities, but I'll take it in this case for many reasons. First, it's one of the last things we'll see from the much-missed Chad Jensen. Second, it adds a new nationality to the game, the Americans. And then mostly, I just really like the game engine, so new content for it is a bonus. GMT also hinted at a new coin game, a new Mark Herman game, and a new Down in Flames game. So lots going on there as always. What's on the table? Okay, well, I think I'm going to dispense with the total rundown of everything I've been playing, as so much of it is the same thing month after month, and you're probably tired of hearing about a bunch of it, but maybe I'll just do a few highlights and what's new on the tables. I shut down one of my Commands & Colors Ancients streams in order to finally give more of a try to Commands & Colors Medieval. I'd only played it once when it first came out. I wasn't much of a fan of the card design or the artwork in this module. Didn't really click with me right away on that first play, so it sat on my shelf ever since. But I'm happy to come back to it and give it a more full play with a new opponent, and hopefully I'll unlock what's good about this game compared to the other Commands & Colors games. Still playing Absolute War, the intro Barbarossa scenario. Wendell managed to take Moscow on turn 4. I wasn't able to dislodge him on turn 5. So one turn to go. I'm getting more familiar with the system. There's lots to like with this game. It just takes a lot of getting used to, as it's unlike many other games on the same subject. We finished up Last 100 Yards Airborne playing Mission 14. I had him whittled down to just 3 units. I kept jumping into close combat with him, surrounding him so that when he lost the close combat, he'd have nowhere to go to. And then I'd get a defender result on the melee, and he'd end up having to take kind of like a double cohesion test for losing. One for losing, another one for retreating through my units. But he kept passing every one, so much so that he finally sort of escaped from all these kind of donuts I had him in. And then he finally won the next initiative roll, so he's able to move away faster than I was able to chase him. Time's out, and he ends up winning because of that. It was a fun game in many ways. I certainly don't mind losing, but it felt like a very gamey situation at the end. No matter how overwhelming my numbers in melee, there's a max DRM of +4 on the assault table, so he managed to escape and then pass all those cohesion tests. Well, I don't know. I guess you can either find it gamey or else it's one hell of a war story, right? Certainly, I imagine my opponent Pete will remember it that way. Another game we played Stonewall's Sword introductory scenario a bit ago. We liked it, so my Blind Swords partner and I tried Thunder in the Ozarks intro scenario. We liked that, so we decided it was time to play a Fulvent Link scenario. So we've gone back to Stonewall's Sword. Things kind of got off on the wrong foot for my Rebels, as he got most of his first turn activations before me and was able to rush onto a couple of the VP hexes on my lower left of the map. It's going to take a while to move him off, as my division commander over there is crap with three is his activation number, so it's hard to get things moving, and also the brigades over there aren't the strongest, so I'm going to kind of have to wait for reinforcements to arrive to be able to move him off those VP spots. Finally, while I'm waiting for my new shelves, I finally broke down, moved everything back off my table, out of my office, so I could get some gaming space back. And I broke out Crossing the Line from VUCA and played a dozen or so activations of that, of the introductory scenario. Very interesting system. Beautiful components. It's, I don't think I've seen a combat system quite like this, and nor an activation system quite like this. It's going to be really interesting. I think, you know, just from first look, the only thing I didn't enjoy is they have markers for step losses. So once the battle gets going, I think pretty much every unit that's involved is going to have some kind of an ugly step loss marker underneath it. It's going to make for some ugly stacks once things get going. And finally, I should also say I started a couple new games of Death of an Army, which I've detailed. I've talked about the game quite a bit on the podcast and on YouTube. But I got finally getting a couple of good opposed plays in, one via Vassal Live that we had our first session of the other night, and went really, really smoothly. Really enjoyed the system so far. And then another one via Vassal PBEM. I'm not sure how well this game is going to work for PBEM, as there's a lot of back and forth between players. But we're going to, you know, we'll check it out, see if it works, and know for next time. It's always great to play with actual opponents when it comes to a game that you've only ever soloed. It's a great way to find any rules you've missed or strategies you've overlooked. Lots of the latter, for sure. There might be one or two boneheaded things that you just missed, and they wake you up to. So that's great. Okay, well, anyway, that's that. Lots of other games still being played as well, but we'll get back, talk more about them down the line. New games to the collection. Always a pleasant thing to talk about, but I have to say I'm very pleased to say that I have neither bought anything new, despite a few trips to the Sentry Box, nor had any surprises show up in the mail this period. I know the scenario pack for Last 100 Yards is on its way, but I think that's about it. I've managed to not burn a hole in my wallet this month, which is probably good news, as I imagine I'll bring something back from the GMT warehouse trip. Books. Do you listen to history podcasts? I listen to a fair few different history podcasts. And some of the best of the past few years were done by Mike Duncan. His History of Rome podcast is legendary, and then he followed that up with Revolutions, a podcast that took a really, really detailed look at a bunch of revolutions, starting with the American Revolution and then finishing recently with the Russian Revolution, a bunch in between. Sort of a monumental task, well worth a listen. Anyway, all this great podcasting got him a book deal, and he got his first book out, but he used all that Revolutions research as a starting point for his second book, Lafayette, Hero of Two Worlds. Given he'd done a deep dive into both the French and American Revolutions, probably a bit of a no-brainer for him. I don't think he's a trained historian, but that might be a plus, as his writing is just as fresh and lively as his podcasts. I listened to those a couple years ago, but what made the book worth reading was its subject. I got to dive back into the American and French Revolutions through a very particular lens, the life of Lafayette. So it was like going through all that history I'd lately been listening to, but from a totally different angle. If you're interested in either revolution, I recommend the book and the podcast if you haven't listened to it yet. Mike Duncan, great stuff. Okay, let's talk about games. The first one, the newer game, is Battle for Kursk, The Daggers Are Burning, 1943, designed by Trevor Bender, first published in the C3I magazine. This is an operational game set around Operational Citadel in 1943. It's a sort of a follow-up game to Battle for Moscow, a game that also appeared in C3 magazine way back in issue 24. This newer game first appeared in C3I 34, but it's also been given the deluxe box treatment by RBM Studio. Both the magazine game and the boxed edition use the same components, though the boxed one has a couple of non-essential extras. I guess its biggest selling point is that it makes the game still available even after the magazine sells out and you get a box. So, that's a plus as well. This is a one-mapper game. It's paper. It's your average 2x3 foot map. It's got about 120 counters in a rule book, and that's it. Most of the things you might often find on player aids, such as CRT and the terrain offense chart, etc., they're all found on the map. So everything's right there. The counters are generally corps for the German and armies for the Soviets. Unit types are simple. They're basically just either infantry or armor. There's also shock infantry, which just basically represent infantry with a little extra artillery. And then the guards units, which represent tanks and mech infantry mixed together, I think. The counters have the standard two number values, combat strength and movement allowance. And then they're also color-coded by unit ID, which has an effect for combat. There's certain things where you want to keep some unit integrity and you'll get some bonuses. The map stretches from north of Moscow, I guess Veliki Luki, down to Odessa, north to south, and then from Kyiv in the west to Voronezh in the east. It's basically what we're looking at here is army group center and army group south, no army group north here. That map is, it's 28 hexes north, south, and 19 hexes east, west. So you can divide that stretch to find out what the actual distance across a hex is. I have no idea. The initial setup has each side starting in a line that stretches from Veliki Luki in the northwest almost down to the farther bottom right corner at Taganrog in the southeast, and Kursk itself is roughly in the center. And the game starts basically with the line intact, one unit per hex all along the line of this diagonal line across the map board. The Germans have maybe three units behind the line in reserve, and the Russians have a dozen or so maybe. So they start a little more with a little bit more flexibility. The game is a fairly straightforward hex and counters operational game. It's kind of a perfect choice to introduce the curious to old school wargaming, I'd say. But it does have one trick up its sleeve that makes it more than just an introductory game, but I'll get to that later. Movement in this game is pretty straightforward. Each unit has a movement allowance, and each terrain or hex side has a movement cost. There's a bit of chrome where infantry units can use rail lines to speed up movement. Stacking is only a single unit per hex, though you can move through friendly units, you just can't end on them. At that single unit per hex, stacking makes this extra friendly for new players as well, I think. Zones of control are simple. You must stop upon entering an enemy zone of control, but it doesn't cost anything to leave one if you start your movement in one. Beware, if you have to retreat and end up in an enemy zone of control, your unit is eliminated. And any unit retreating through an enemy zone of control loses a step. Combat will be fairly familiar to veteran wargamers as well. It's between adjacent hexes. The attacker chooses the target and can attack it from as many units as they have adjacent to the target. Total up all the attacking combat values, divide by the defending combat values, you get a familiar odds ratio. Adjust for defensive terrain, roll the dice, consult the combat results table, and you'll get a result. If the defender is eliminated or retreats, the attacker can advance into the target hex. Pretty standard stuff. There's a couple of interesting wrinkles to this, though. The first I find a bit of a pain in the ass, but it's definitely in the rules. And that is that all combats must be announced before any are resolved. Playing live, we definitely skipped this out our results weren't maybe exactly as the designer intended, but it just seemed easier to do them, to go down the line and do them as one at a time instead of deeming all of them at once. But the other twist is a little more interesting. When you're attacking with an armor unit or a shock army unit, you can declare an offensive, and then any units in the same corps or army of the lead unit that are not adjacent to the defending unit but are adjacent to the lead attacking unit, They'll cause to shift the attack one column right on the CRT. So if your initial attack is only 1-to-1, but you have two adjacent related units to make it an offensive, you shift from the 1-to-1 column over to the 3-to-1 column, and you have a much better attack. And to make it even better, these units can also take step losses if needed. The only hits to this is each time you conduct an offensive like this, you have to spend an offensive marker. Each side starts with a limited amount of these markers, but more are awarded on certain turns as per the turn record track. So, you can set up these larger offensives as opposed to just general local attacks up and down the line. The CRT has basically familiar results: defender eliminated, defender retreat, and a step loss. Exchange, attacker step loss, and no effect. It's all pretty self-explanatory. Given it's an East Front game, there are some weather effects. Nothing too hard. On three of the game turns, there's mud, which slows down movement and reduces the combat strength of the armor units. But if you don't want to play with the historical weather, there's a random weather table as well. It still skews towards the historical, but allows for some variation, which is that's my favorite kind of random chart. The one that isn't totally random, but skews towards the historical, but allows some variability. I like that quite a bit. Okay, I said there's one more twist that makes this a really interesting game, and here it is. It's this game has something that's called a posture track. Each turn, each player will have to decide what posture to put his forces in for that turn. You have four choices: pause, reposition, deploy, or engage. And the choice you make affects a couple things. The further towards the pause end of the track you pick, the less you can do, but the better the supply of reemplacements you'll receive that turn. Whereas the further towards the engage end of the track you go, the less you receive in terms of replacements, but the more you can do in terms of movement and combat. In terms of replacements, there's an amount given to each side each turn on the turn track, and you can get a little bit more or a little less depending on what your posture is. As for actions, the posture track is clever. Each player's turn is divided into phases, and each of the postures lets you participate in only certain phases. For example, if you choose pause, you only get to do the first phase, the replacement phase, whereas if you choose engage, you get to do all four. You get the replacement phase, the armor and rail movement phase, the combat phase, and then the full movement phase. Reposition posture allows you to do replacement and final movement, while deploy lets you do replacement and both types of movement. So, the four postures, very interesting. You might have noticed in what I just said, it's also interesting to note that regular movement comes after combat. That's going to take you a little bit to get used to the first time you play this game if you're a veteran player. The final thing to note about the postures is that it's a scale, sort of like a 1-4 scale, and you can generally only move up or down one rung on the scale from turn to turn. You can go from pause to reinforcement or whatever it's called. You can go from deploy to engagement. Just one step. If you want to move more than one rung on the scale, it'll cost you an offensive marker. There's also a historical schedule for the postures, which I didn't have much use for, but then I thought, well, that might make for a better solo experience, because in the normal game, postures are selected secretly and then revealed simultaneously at the start of every turn. But if you were soloing this game, you could just use the historical schedule for both sides, and that would take that chunk of the not knowing out of it. Anyway, that's the nuts and bolts of how it plays. Victories achieved by taking key cities with a small bonus for eliminating more units than your opponent. There's a few other bits of chrome. The map gradually expands or changes each side's fortified areas as the turns progress. There's also an opportunity for each side to set specific objectives, which change the VC just slightly. And then there's a shorter scenario as well that starts right into the big fighting if you want to play a quicker game. Or then there's the longer regular scenario, which basically has kind of four extra early turns at the beginning while forces build up sort of before the big offensives really start. I had a really good time playing this opposed over Vassal Live. We were inexperienced players, and I think the game took us between 3 and 4 hours, maybe. Something like that. It's a very close game, plenty of back and forth. I have to say the posture decisions were often agonizing. I was constantly wanting to engage, but then not getting enough replacements to keep my line together. It's and that's sort of important because it's very much a game about breaking the line. Yeah, really enjoyable. The Vassal module, straightforward, worked great for live play. I haven't tried it PBEM, so I can't comment there. But for Vassal live play, it was perfect. It was great. I really enjoyed the game. I look forward to the next iteration in C3i Magazine. I think it might be on North Africa. No guarantees. That just came into my head. Maybe. Anyway, yeah, I really look forward to it. I have to say, no slight to Mark Herman's fine work, but it's going to be refreshing to not have yet another working of Empire of the Sun as the included game. It'll feel a little bit fresh. So that's Battle for Kursk. The Tigers are Burning, 1943, available from RBM Studio. Check it out. Time for this episode's older game. This time we have Hammer of the Scots, designed by, well, the credits officially say Tom Daglish and Jerry Taylor. I always think of this series of games as Jerry Taylor's games, but maybe with this first one he had a lot of help from Tom Daglish. I don't know. It's anyway, published by Columbia Games in 2009. So this is an oldie, but it's not really an oldie. It's funny. It spawned so many more games. It feels like it should be older. I guess, Columbia had been doing block games where only the owner could see what the unit was and how strong it was, depending on what side it was rotated to. The thing with Hammer of the Scots was it added a new twist by also categorizing each unit as A, B, or C, and a 1, 2, or 3 sort of thing. And then it sort of changed how combat works. More on that later, but it was definitely something new in the Columbia Block Games universe when it first came out. Hammer of the Scots takes place in the 1300s. It's about the wars for Scottish independence. There's two scenarios, one that runs from 1287 to 1305, and another one that's from 1306. To 1314, or you can put them both together for a giant campaign game. I've never done that. I've played both of the scenarios. They're sort of equal in size. Neither one is a big one and a little one. They're both sort of mid-size, but I've never run them together for the giant thing. The map is of Scotland with just the top of England along the southern edge. In terms of components, it's not exactly a paper map. It's kind of a heavy cardboard map, but it's not as thick as a mounted map. It's an area movement map divided into 23 areas. It's a block game. Nice Columbia blocks. They always have great blocks. With the Scots taking the blue blocks and the English the red. The blocks are either leaders, such as Edward I or William Wallace, or nobles, or troops. Each block will have a sticker on one flat side indicating what it is, along with a series of pips along two to four of the edges, which sort of tells you what the strength is. You stand each block up facing you with a number of pips on the top edge indicating what the current strength of the unit is. And of course, your opponent will only see the blank backside. When a block takes hits, you simply turn them to show a lower amount of pips on the top side until they're eliminated. Each of the nobles has a home area on the map. That's where they'll start each new year as well. They also get a small bonus of one extra die if they're defending in their home area. That's worth remembering. Each area also has what's called a castle limit. This is a limit as to how many units can stay in that area between turns, or what's called wintering in the game, as well as how many strength points can be built there each winter. There's also cards in the game. They're not particularly attractive, but they're totally functional. If you played other Columbia games, you'll know exactly what to expect here. They're not like regular playing cards at all. They look like the old kind of cards you might get in a Parker Brothers game or something back when you were a kid. Victory in the game is determined by who controls the most nobles at the end. Now, that might seem a little weird, but the deal is the number of nobles fluctuates because they switch sides whenever they're defeated in combat. So that's how it can the number fluctuates. So that's basically what it looks like. So how does it work? At the start of a turn, each player is dealt 5 cards. The cards are mostly movement cards numbered 1 to 3, but there's also a few event cards sprinkled in. Each turn is a year. Both players will play all 5 of their cards each year. After drawing their 5-card hand, each player selects a card, plays it face down, and then they reveal them simultaneously. If either player plays an event, the event is resolved immediately. If they both play events, both resolved immediately, and then the year immediately ends with no further card play. But usually, both will probably play a numbered movement card. And whoever played the higher number moves first, with ties making the English player go first. The number on the movement cards indicates how many groups of units you can activate that round. Each block can move either 2 or 3 areas, depending on the type of unit they are. They have to stop when entering an enemy-occupied area or when crossing certain colored border lines. As well, only 6 blocks may cross a green border, and only 2 blocks can cross a red borderline. So if the Scots player had played a 3-card and the English player had played a 1-card, the Scots player would go first. They would select 3 areas to move units from, and then they'd make their moves, and then the English player would select their 1 area to move from and make their moves. Note that if the first player moves some of their units into an area that has an enemy unit or units in it, it's going to pin an equal number of those enemy units to that zone and keep them from moving out. It's not easy to run away in this game. After each player has made their moves, combat occurs in all contested spaces. Combat in each area lasts a maximum of 3 rounds, and if it isn't decisive by then, the attacker must retreat. If an area is being attacked by more than 1 force coming over different borders due to the border limits, one of the groups has to be cleared the lead attack group, and then any other groups that come over, they'll be added to that contested area in reserve, and they won't take part in the first round of battle. They can only take part in the second and third round of battle. Same thing goes for any groups the defender might bring in on their move if they reinforce that contested area. As I noted earlier, all units are rated A, B, or C. This is important in battle because the A's strike before B's, which strike before C's, and the defender always strikes before the attacker, but within the ranks. So defenders' A's go first, then attackers' A's, then defenders' B's, attackers' B's, so on. Combat isn't simultaneous, so whatever hits you take before your turn to roll with certain units will degrade that unit's combat strength. Units are also rated numerically, and this basically tells you what numbers they will hit with. So an A3 unit will hit on 1s, 2s, and 3s. A B2 unit would only hit on 1s and 2s. A C4 unit, if there is such a thing, would strike last, but it would hit on 1s, 2s, 3s, and 4s. And then, of course, finally, the current strength of the unit, the number of pips on its uppermost side, that determines how many dice that unit gets to attack with. So this sets up some interesting choices in battle. When your opponent scores hits on you, you have to apply it to the unit with the most pips. But if you have more than one unit tied with the most pips, you get to decide. So do you take the hit on a crappy unit, but this has yet to have its turn to strike in combat yet? Or is it better off to take the hit on a unit that's already battled, even if it was a better unit? Because that'll at least leave you with an extra die to use when you finally get to use your crappy unit. It's not ground-shaking stuff, but it's fun and interesting decisions. After the first round of combat, any extra units from reserve that also moved into the contested area now also join the battle, and you do a second round and then a third round of combat. And as I said earlier, if the attacker hasn't won after three rounds, then the attacker has to retreat. But retreating is always possible instead of participating. But interestingly, it's done on a unit-by-unit basis at the time each unit is eligible for combat. So you can't retreat your Cs before the other person has fired their As or their Bs. And also note that those border limits are still in place, so it might not be possible to easily retreat a large force all at once anyway. During the battle, any nobles that are eliminated immediately switch sides and go to the other player as a one-strength unit in reserve. If there's still rounds left in the battle, they'll become active in the next round. Any troops blocks eliminated go back to the owner's draw pool, and perhaps they'll come back later in the game. The English king blocks, Edward I and II, have a few special rules as how they... I think it's Edward I. If you kill Edward I, I think the game's over. But Edward II might have a different rule. And there's special rules for the Scottish leader blocks as well, for the Bruce and for William Wallace. And there's actually even a Scottish king block, and the same thing happens. If that block comes into play and is eliminated, the Scots automatically lose, I think, too. Anyway, there's a few special rules for all these leader blocks. All of it a bit chromey, but all of it fun. After all the battles are resolved, both players play their next card, and the whole thing happens again, and so on until both players have played all five of their cards. Then it's end of the year and time for wintering. There's more fun here, as in the winter, all the nobles have to go back to their home area. If you still own that area, that's good. But if a noble's home area is now controlled by their opponent, the noble instantly switches side and keeps his current strength. So this happens fairly often in the game, at least in... Maybe we're just not good players, but you take an area for your opponent's noble, and then manage to get a decent noble as an extra when the wintering happens. Any blocks still in England must disband and go back to the draw pool, so it's incumbent on the English player to make sure that he moves all of his units at some point out of England and into Scotland, as well as any English archers, knights, or hobelars that aren't stacked with the king. They have to disband as well. If they are stacked with the king, they can winter with the king. Well, I should say, Edward I may winter in Scotland, but not 2 years in a row. If you're playing the English, you have to declare whether he's going to winter in Scotland or not. The Scots can hold on to all their units, subject to castle limits for each area, as we discussed earlier. And then each side gets to replenish a few pips in each area it controls, again, subject to the castle limits. The Scots player can either rebuild a strength point on a unit in an area or draw a unit from their pool and deploy it with a strength of one into that area. The English can only use the castle limit points to increase the strength of on-map units. To bring their units back from their draw pool, they get what they call the English levy every turn. They get to randomly draw half the units from their draw pool. But only in terms where Edward is not wintering in Scotland. So if he stays in Scotland, the English forego their levy that term. These freshly levied units always start in England. And then that's the end of the turn. The year marker is advanced. Each player draws five new cards, and we do it all again. At the end of the game, whoever has the most nobles wins. Or, you know, there's a sudden death if the English king is ever captured, or if one side ends up with all the nobles, that's a sudden death victory as well. This was the first game of its kind, and it spawned several more along the same lines. There's Richard III, Julius Caesar, and Crusader Rex. I think probably Julius Caesar is maybe the best of the games. Richard III, I don't have, but just going by what I've read, Julius Caesar game might be the best of these. It's certainly the most elegant production-wise, but I got to say, I still have a kind of a soft spot for Hammer of the Scots. I like the loud colors on the blocks. I get that the bottom of the map has a few choke points that constrain maneuver and dictate play and movement to a certain extent, but I got to say, it's still damn fun. There's plenty of randomness with the buckets of dice approach to battle. There's lots of fog of war due to the one-sided blocks. It adds up to a game that's way more game than simulation, but it's a really fun game. I don't know. Perhaps if I'd played it 50 times instead of a half dozen or so, I'd be tired of the map. Hard to know. But in the times I've played it, each play has felt different enough for me to want to come back and play it again and to play other games in the series. So definitely this game led me to the others. I've played this game using the Vassal module, PBEM. It's a bit dated. I think this module hasn't been updated since 2016. But it was it's still totally functional. Just don't expect much in the way of automation. But yeah, I recommend you, if you haven't ever checked it out, give Hammer the Scots a try from Columbia Games. All right, time for bouquets and brickbats. First, let me start with an update to last episode's brickbat. No, IKEA has not got the shelves in yet, so my games are still in these giant stacks, definitely not doing their boxes any good. Well, I sit here and wait. I've checked out tons of other possibilities, but I haven't found anything as flexible for as good a price as what I'm trying to buy from IKEA, so I wait. Come on, IKEA! That said, for my bouquet this episode, I wanted to give a shout-out to all my PBM partners scattered all around the world. I've played folks from all kinds of different continents and countries around the world. But I'll highlight one in particular, as I think I've played as many games against him as almost anyone via PBM. It's my regular opponent, Dave Blizzard. Our current total is 87 matches in climbing, all of them by PBEM. I think we might have played a few things on Rally the Troops or Yakata or some of those things. But anyway, they're all remote asynchronous plays. I knew Dave's son before I met him, as we were both working on some of the same shows together, and I'd acted with his son's wife in a play or two back in the day. But then I joined a group playing an online version of the old 3M Avalon Hill game Speed Circuit, and that's where I first met Dave. We were racing against each other. Through that, we managed to figure out we had a couple of common friends. I think maybe Dave recognized my name from a program of something he'd seen with his kid or his daughter-in-law. I'm not sure. Anyway, we got in contact and started playing other games online. We've played a ton of Commands and Colors Ancients. He's beat me mercilessly at Rommel at the Desert. We've also played Imperial Struggle, Shores of Tripoli, Pax Porfiriana. There's probably others. According to my records, he's won 52% of those games. So I feel like we're a pretty well-matched pair. He's always up for something new and ready to move on if a game doesn't keep his interest. I know he plays a wide variety of non-war games as well. He's a big part of the local gaming scene here in Calgary before I ever met him, and he moved out west. Like many Grand Yards, he's starting to get up there in age and has had his fair share of health scares, but he keeps on ticking. So hats off to Dave and to all the friends I've made playing via Vassal and online over the years. It's really opened up my wargaming horizons for sure. Parting shots. I was listening to a podcast about war games the other day, and the host said he didn't really like competitive games. He preferred co-op games. He was decrying the lack of co-op games in the war game hobby. Yeah, I'm not a co-op player at all. It's not that I'm competitive, not at all. It's I'm happy just to play and see how the thing turns out. But I like to try to win at least, and I really like to try match wits with my opponent. The reason I don't generally like solo games is because I don't feel the same wit matching when playing against an AI, and I don't find that AIs generally make the same blunders that me and my live opponents make. Anyway, that's sort of why I don't like co-op games as well, I suppose. Anyway, I found it sort of strange that a war game player would be looking only to play cooperatively. That was a unique perspective to me. I don't know. What do you think? Is co-op war games going to be the new thing? The icing on the cake was when the host said that he felt uncomfortable. The reason he didn't like competitive games was because he was uncomfortable when he was winning in a blowout, and he felt sorry for the losing player, that he couldn't see how the losing player had much fun. I don't know. Well, his panelists tried to persuade him that you can have fun even while losing, but the host just wouldn't budge on the topic. I think what no one really brought up in that conversation was the fact that, at least in my experience, games aren't generally blowouts. One side winning in a rout doesn't happen all that often. I know we've all been on both sides of the equation often enough to be familiar with it, but for me, it's just not a big enough thing to worry about. I'm not trying to say we don't need more co-op war games or that I'm against co-op war games. It's like all the other games. If folks want them, I hope they get them. There's plenty of room for all. There's plenty of room for all the games that I like, and if they make more of the type that you like, it doesn't take away any of that I like. I guess I just bring it up because I found the reasoning strange, but I wondered if it was just me. Something I wonder more and more the older I get. I don't know. Maybe more and more players are feeling like they don't want to compete against another human player. I mean, I'm all for participation medals, but for me, a game is between people, not with people. If you want to do something cooperatively with me, come help me build a new fence. Anyway, what do you think? Drop by the website, vote in a poll, leave a comment, register, have your say in our forums, however you like. You can hit me up at pushingcardboard.com or at cardboardpusher on Twitter. We also have a Discord server. You can probably find a link to that on our website or probably through the Discord search. Thanks for listening. I'm Grant Lindeberg. If you enjoyed it, tell a friend. If you didn't, tell your mom. And talk to you next time.